that it could be true, that the sun could be her halo, that the leaves could exist to marvel at her every step, to urge her on, to congratulate her on this Francis, what the two of them had done. They had celebrated their shimmering youth, their freedom, their wet mouths, and had done so in public, fueled by the knowledge that whatever hardships they had faced or would face, they were working at the center of the world and trying mightily to improve it. They had reason to feel good. May wondered if she was in love. No, she knew she was not in love, but she was, she felt, at least halfway. That week, she and Francis ate lunch together often, even if briefly, and after they ate, they found a place to lean against each other and kiss. Once it was under a fire exit behind the Paleozoic. Once it was in the Roman Empire, behind the paddle courts. She loved his taste, always clean, simple, like lemon water, and how he would remove his glasses, look briefly lost, then would close his eyes and look almost beautiful, his face as smooth and uncomplicated as a child's. Having him near brought a new crackle to the days. Everything was astounding. Eating was astounding, under the bright sun, the heat of his shirt, his hands on her ankle. Walking was astounding. Sitting in the Enlightenment was astounding, as they were now doing, awaiting Dream Friday in the Great Hall. "Pay attention," Francis said. "I really think you'll like this." Francis wouldn't tell me what the subject of that Friday's innovation talk was. The speaker, Gus Cazzani, had apparently been part of Francis's child safety project before he spun off, 4 months ago, to head up a new unit. Today would be his first airing of his findings and new plan. May and Francis sat near the front, at Gus's request. He wanted to see some friendly faces as he spoke, for the first time in the Great Hall, Francis said. May turned to scan the crowd, seeing Dan a few rows back, and Renata and Sabine sitting together, concentrating on a tablet laid between them. Eamon Bailey stepped onto the stage to warm applause.
"Well, we really have a treat for you today," he said. "Most of you know our local treasure and jack-of-all-trades, Gus Cazzani, and most of you know he had an inspiration a while back that we urged him to follow. Today he'll do a bit of a presentation, and I think you'll really like it."
And with that, he ceded the stage to Gus, who had the odd combination of preternaturally good looks and a timid, mouse-like demeanor. Or at least it seemed that way, as he pittered across the stage like he was tiptoeing.
"Okay, if you're like me, you're single and pathetic and forever a disappointment to your Persian mother and father and grandparents who see you as a failure for not having a mate and children by now because you're pathetic."
Laughs from the audience.
"Did I use the word pathetic twice?"
More laughter.
"If my family was here, it would have been many more times."
"Okay," Gus continued. "But let's say you want to please your family, and maybe yourself too, by finding a mate. Anyone interested in finding a mate here?"
A few hands rose up.
"Oh, come on, you liars. I happen to know that 67% of this company is unmarried, so I'm talking to you. The other 33% can go to hell."
May laughed out loud. Gus's delivery was perfect. She leaned over to Francis.
"I love this guy." He continued. "Now maybe you tried other dating sites, and let's say you're matched up and that's all good, and you're headed out for a rendezvous. All good, the family's happy, they briefly entertain the idea that you're not a worthless use of their shared DNA. Now the second you ask someone out, you're screwed, right? Actually, you're not screwed. You're celibate, but you want to change that. So you spend the rest of the week stressing over where to take them. Food, concert, wax museum, some kind of dungeon. You have no idea. The wrong choice, and you're an idiot. You know that you have a wide variety of tastes, things you like, and they probably do too, but that first choice is too important. You need help to send the right message. The message being that you're sensitive, intuitive, decisive. You have good taste. And you're perfect."
The crowd was laughing. They hadn't stopped laughing. The screen behind Gus now showed a grid of icons with information listed clearly below each. May could make out what seemed to be symbols for a restaurant, for movies, music, shopping, outdoor activities, beaches.
"Okay," Gus continued. "So check this out. And remember, it's just a beta version. This is called Love Love. Okay, maybe that name sucks. Actually, I know it sucks, and we're working on it, but this is how it works.
When you found someone and you have their name, you made contact, you have a date planned, this is when love comes in. Maybe you've already memorized their dating site page, their personal page, all their feeds, but this love gives you an entirely different set of information. So you feed in your date's name, that's a start, then love scans the web and uses some high-powered and very surgical search machinery to ensure that you don't make an ass out of yourself and that you might find love and produce grandchildren for your baba, who thinks you might be sterile.
"You're awesome, Gus,"
a woman's voice yelled from the audience.
"Thank you. Will you go out with me?"
he said, and waited for an answer. When the woman went quiet, he said,
"See, this is why I need help. Now, to test this software, I think we require an actual person who wants to find out more about an actual potential romantic interest. Can I have a volunteer?"
Gus looked out to the audience, theatrically peering around with his hand shielding his eyes.
"No one? Oh, wait, I see a hand up."
To May's shock and horror, Gus was looking her way. More specifically, he was looking at Francis, whose hand was raised. And before she could say anything to him, Francis was out of his seat and headed up to the stage.
"Give this brave volunteer a round of applause,"
Gus said, and Francis jogged up the steps and was enveloped in the warm spotlight next to Gus. He had not looked back to May since he'd left her side.
"Now, what is your name, sir?"
"Francis Garaventa."
May thought she'd puke. What was happening? This isn't real, she said to herself. Was he really going to talk about her on stage? No, she assured herself. He's just helping a friend, and they'll do their demonstration using fake names.
"Now, Francis," Gus continued, "am I to assume you have someone you'd like to date?"
"Yes, Gus, that is correct."
May, dizzy and terrified, nonetheless couldn't help noticing that on stage, Francis was transformed, just as Gus had been. He was playing along, showing his teeth, acting shy, but doing so with great confidence.
"Is that person a real person?"
Gus asked.
"Of course," Francis said. "I no longer date imaginary people."
The crowd laughed heartily, and May's stomach dropped to her shoes. Oh, shit, she thought. Oh, shit.
"And her name?"
"Her name is May Holland,"
Francis said, and for the first time looked down to her. Her face was in her hands, her eyes peeking from under her trembling fingers. With an almost imperceptible tilt of his head, he seemed to register that May wasn't entirely comfortable with the proceedings thus far. But just as soon as he acknowledged her, he turned back to Gus, grinning like a game show host.
"Okay," Gus said, typing the name into his tablet. "May Holland."
In the search box, her name appeared in 3-foot letters on the screen.
"So Francis wants to go out with May, and he doesn't want to make an ass out of himself. What's one of the first things he needs to know? Anyone?"
"Allergies,"
someone yelled.
"Okay, allergies. I can search for that."
He clicked on an icon of a cat sneezing, and immediately a stanza appeared below. "Likely gluten allergy, definite horse allergy, mother has nut allergy, no other likely allergies."
"Okay, I can click on any one of these listings and find out more. Let's try the gluten one."
Gus clicked on the first line, revealing a more complex and dense scroll of links and text blocks.
"Now, as you can see, Love has searched everything May's ever posted. It's collated this information and analyzed it for relevance. Maybe May's mentioned gluten. Maybe she's bought or reviewed gluten-free products. This would indicate she's likely gluten allergic."
May wanted to leave the auditorium, but knew it would make more of a scene than staying.
"Now let's look at the horse one,"
Gus said, and clicked on the next listing.
"Here, we can make a more definite assertion, given it's found 3 instances of messages posted that directly say, for example, 'I'm allergic to horses.'" "So does that help you?"
Gus asked.
"It does,"
Francis said.
"I was about to take her to some stables to eat leavened bread,"
he mugged to the audience.
"Now I know."
The audience laughed, and Gus nodded as if to say,
"Aren't we a pair?"
"Okay,"
Gus continued.
"Now notice that the mentions of the horse allergy were way back in 2010, from Facebook of all places.
For all of you who thought it was silly of us to pay what we did for Facebook's archives, take heed. Okay, no allergies, but check this out, right nearby. This is what I had in mind next. Food. Did you think you might take her out to eat, Francis? Francis answered, gamely. Yes, I did, Gus. May didn't recognize this man on stage. Where had Francis gone? She wanted to kill this version of him. Okay, this is where things usually get ugly and stupid. There's nothing worse than the back and forth. Where do you want to eat? Oh, anything's fine. No, really, what's your preference? Doesn't matter to me. What's yours? No more of that bull shite. Love breaks it down for you. Anytime she's posted, anytime she's liked or disliked a restaurant, anytime she's mentioned food, it all gets ranked and sorted, and I end up with a list like this. He clicked on the food icon, which revealed a number of subset lists with rankings of type of food, names of restaurants, restaurants by city and by neighborhood. The lists were uncanny in their accuracy. They even featured the place she and Francis had eaten earlier that week. Now I click on the place I like, and if she paid through TrueU, I know what she ordered last time she ate there. Click here and see the specials for those restaurants on Friday when our date will happen. Here's the average wait for a table that day. Uncertainty eliminated. Gus went on and on throughout the presentation, into May's preferences for films, for outdoor spaces to walk on and jog through, to favorite sports, favorite vistas. It was accurate, most of it. And while Gus and Francis hammed it up on stage and the audience grew ever more impressed with the software, May had first hidden behind her hands, then sunk to the lowest possible place in her seat, and finally, when she felt at any moment she'd be asked to get on stage to confirm the great power of this new tool, she slipped out of her seat, across the aisle, out the auditorium's side door, and into the flat white light of an overcast afternoon. I'm sorry. May couldn't look at him. May, sorry. I don't understand why you're so mad. She did not want him near her. She was back at her desk, and he'd followed her there, standing over her like some carrion bird. She didn't glance at him, because besides loathing him and finding his face weak and his eyes shifty, besides being sure she'd never need to see that wretched face again, she had work to do. The afternoon shoot had been opened, and the flow was heavy. We can talk later, she said to him, but she had no intention of talking to him again, that day or any day. There was relief in that certainty. Eventually he left, at least his corporeal self left, but he appeared in minutes on her third screen, pleading for forgiveness. He told her he knew he shouldn't have sprung it on her, but that Gus had insisted on it being a surprise. He sent 40 or 50 messages throughout the afternoon, apologizing, telling her what a big hit she was, how it would have been even better if she'd gotten on stage because people were clapping for her. He assured her that everything that had been on screen was publicly available, none of it embarrassing, all of it culled from things she'd posted herself, after all. And May knew all this to be true. She wasn't angry at the revelation of her allergies or her favorite foods. She had openly offered this information for many years, and she felt that offering her preferences and reading about others was one of the things she loved about her life online. So what had mortified her during Gus's presentation? She couldn't put her finger on it. Was it only the surprise of it? Was it the pinpoint accuracy of the algorithms? Maybe. But then again, it wasn't entirely accurate, so was that the problem? Having a matrix of preferences presented as your essence, as the whole you, maybe that was it. It was some kind of mirror, but it was incomplete, distorted. And if Francis wanted any or all of that information, why couldn't he just ask her? Her third screen, though, all afternoon, was filled with congratulatory messages. You're awesome, May. Good job, newbie. No horseback rides for you. Maybe a llama? She pushed through the afternoon and didn't notice her blinking phone till after 5. She'd missed 3 messages from her mother. When she listened to them, they all said the same thing. Come home. As she drove over the hills and through the tunnel, heading east, she called her mom and got the details. Her father had had a seizure, had gone to the hospital, was asked to spend the night for observation. May was told to drive directly there, but when she arrived, he was gone. She called her mother. Where is he? Home. Sorry, we just got here. I didn't think you'd get out here so soon. He's fine. So May drove home, and when she arrived, breathless and angry and scared, she saw Mercer's Toyota pickup in the driveway, and this sent her into a mental bramble. She didn't want him here.
It complicated an already gory scene. She opened the door and saw not her parents, but Mercer's giant, shapeless form. He was standing in the foyer. Every time she saw him again after time apart, she was jarred by how big he was, how lumpy. His hair was longer now, adding to his mass. His head blocked all light.
"Heard your car," he said.
He had a pear in his hand. "Why are you here?" she asked.
"They called me to help," he said.
"Dad?" She rushed past Mercer and into the living room. There, her father was resting, lengthwise, on the couch, watching baseball on the television. He didn't turn his head, but looked her way.
"Hey, hon. Heard you out there."
May sat on the coffee table and held his hand. "You okay?"
"I am. Just a scare, really. It started strong, but petered out."
Almost imperceptibly, he was inching his head forward to see around her. "Are you trying to watch the game?"
"Ninth inning," he said.
May moved out of the way. Her mother entered the room.
"We called Mercer to help get your father into the car."
"I didn't want the ambulance,"
her father said, still watching the game.
"So was it a seizure?" May asked.
"They're not sure,"
Mercer said from the kitchen. "Can I hear the answer from my own parents?" May called out.
"Mercer was a lifesaver," her father said.
"Why didn't you call me to say it wasn't so serious?" May asked.
"It was serious," her mother said. "That's when I called.
But now he's watching baseball."
"It's not as serious now," her mother said, "but for a while there, we really didn't know what was happening, so we called Mercer."
"He saved my life."
"I don't think Mercer saved your life, Dad."
"I don't mean that I was dying, but you know how I hate the whole circus with the EMTs and the sirens and the neighbors knowing. We just called Mercer. He got here in 5 minutes, helped me get to the car, into the hospital, and that was that. It made all the difference."
May fumed. She'd driven 2 hours in a red panic to find her father relaxing on the couch watching baseball. She'd driven 2 hours to find her ex in her home, anointed the hero of the family. And what was she? She was somehow negligent? She was superfluous. It reminded her of so many of the things she didn't like about Mercer. He liked to be considered kind, but he made sure everyone knew it, and that drove May mad, always having to hear about his kindness, his straight-upness, his reliability, his boundless empathy. But with her, he'd been diffident, moody, unavailable too many times she needed him.
"You want some chicken? Mercer brought some,"
her mother said, and May decided that was a good cue to use her bathroom for a few minutes, or 10. "I'm going to clean up," she said, and went upstairs. Later, after they'd all eaten and recounted the day, explaining how her father's vision had diminished to an alarming state and the numbness in his hands had worsened, symptoms the doctor said were normal and treatable, or at least addressable, and after her parents had gone to bed, May and Mercer sat in the backyard, the heat still coming off the grass, the trees, the rain-washed gray fences that surrounded them.
"Thanks for helping," she said.
"It was easy. Vinny's lighter than he used to be."
May didn't like the sound of that. She didn't want her father to be lighter, easily carried. She changed the subject.
"How's business?"
"Really good. Really good. I actually had to take on an apprentice last week. Isn't that cool? I have an apprentice." "And your job? Great?"
May was taken aback. Mercer was rarely so ebullient.
"It is great," she said.
"Good. Good to hear. I was hoping it'd work out. So you're doing what? Programming or something?"
"I'm in CE, customer experience. I deal with the advertisers right now. Wait, I saw something about your stuff the other day. I looked you up and there was this comment about someone getting something shipped damaged. They were so pissed. I'm assuming you saw that."
Mercer exhaled theatrically.
"I didn't."
His face had gone sour. "Don't worry," she said. "It was just some nut job."
"And now it's in my head."
Don't blame me. You just made me aware that there's some kook out there who hates me and wants to hurt my business. There were other comments, too, and most of them were nice.